Well, I'm delighted to say we've got another Irish guy on the show today. He has been a world champion. I think that the insights that he can share to be the best at anything that you do will hopefully give you loads of lessons, teach us all something. And I think if we can get something from this where we can understand the mindset of a world champion, I think the next 60 minutes are going to be worth it. So let's get into this. Hi everyone, and welcome back, or welcome to The Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh, and as an elite athlete, I truly believe that my 20-year playing career was as a result of my mindset and attitude. And the ability to empower yourself through your thinking was transformative for me, and the reason why I do what I do now is 100% down to my mentality, which is the perfect segue into my next guest. Because if you're going to be the best in the world in your profession, then the 6 inches between your ears must play a pivotal role. So let's welcome world snooker champion, Ken Doherty. Ken, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Paul. Very, very well. Thank you.
Good man. Good to have you on The Psychology of Success. And it's great to see you, have another fellow Irishman on the show as well. And I'm going to kick off the way we do with everyone who's been on the show so far and ask you The first question, which is, what is the definition of success?
Well, it can be measured in lots of ways, I suppose. It's very hard to put it into just one simple sentence, but it depends on your outlook, I suppose. You know, when people say, oh, well, you know, winning the world championship, that you'll always be remembered for that. But there was lots of pathways to reaching the pinnacle, which was, of course, winning the world championship. But there was lots of great successes. I mean, you know, you could look at sort of Jimmy White. He's never won the world championship, but he still had a very, very successful career and lots of successes. But for me, I suppose I'll always be remembered for winning the world championship and, you know, lifting it up and putting my name on the cup along with the great, you know, fellow Irishman Alex Higgins, who won it, you know, in 72 and 82. And, of course, Dennis Taylor, will never forget that Blackpool final in 1985. They were sort of big inspirations for me. So to go alongside them on the cup was absolutely fantastic. You know?
So I think it's interesting because we're probably going to go straight into the work side of life and the career. And that's what, you know, potentially what the definition you're talking about there. So I'd just really be interested in Ken in understanding how that happens, you know, because you don't wake up somebody as a world snooker champion. And, you know, the old phrase of, you know, it takes a lifetime of achievement to become an overnight success. So where did it really start for you? Because I'm guessing you must have been seeing this on TV and potentially being inspired by what you saw.
Absolutely. I don't remember, whether you remember Pop Black all those years ago when it came on TV. Yeah. Like when I saw Pop Black first, I think it was only about 8 years of age. My father used to put it on a Thursday night. It'd come on for about a half an hour. They'd play two single frames. So they'd have like a couple of matches. And that was the first time I saw Alex Higgins, the first time I saw snooker on TV, and I was absolutely fascinated by it. I asked Santa for a small little snooker table, which was at the end of my bunk bed. It was only about this size, that Christmas, and that would have been around 1977. And from then, I was absolutely hooked and mesmerized. I wanted to, you know, the table would come out, we'd put it on the kitchen table, or we'd put it on the floor, and we'd play away with my brothers and my father. And we was lucky because we had a couple of snooker clubs in the little village that I lived in, Renla. And I used to be able to go in there maybe on a Sunday afternoon. That was because I was so young. But as I sort of got a little bit older, it was sort of every day straight after school, school bag under the snooker table. I used to like sweep the floors, empty the ashtrays, do a little bit of hoovering, get a free game on the Space Invaders, on the pool, and even on the snooker table. I mean, when I started playing on the big tables around the Jasons and Renla back in those in the late 70s, early 80s, I used to have those old Jacobs biscuit tins. I used to have to stand up and play and kick the biscuits in around the table. But I was still, funny enough, beating my brother and beating his friends and a lot of kids older than me. So I was getting great kudos and I was getting great excitement out of it.
So do you think that's what it is? Because almost when you talked about that small snooker table you had as a kid, I just saw your face lighten up, almost like it's, brought you all the way back as waking up on Christmas morning. Was it just simply the joy of playing snooker, or as you mentioned more at the end of that answer, how you started to become good at it, and then that's a little bit of more significance for you?
That day, the Christmas morning is as clear as it is now, all these years later. And I was in like back then, like I don't know what it was like for you, but the Christmas presents were never sort of wrapped up. They were just put in a box and they were at the end of the bunk bed. And I was so excited just picking up the snooker table. It was just I can it does. It sort of brings a little tear to my eye because they're sort of images that you never forget. And they were that was like an inspiration, and the fact that I got so much pleasure out playing, it was the excitement of competition, of taking other guys on, of beating them, the exhilaration, the adrenaline sort of fueled games that I used to have. And that, football used to give it to me a little bit, but not the same as it used to playing snooker. I used to play football for the local football team. I was captain of the local football team. But I sort of gave it up when I was about 15 to concentrate on playing snooker. But I think it was just the excitement, the competition, trying to get better, the excitement of getting better, beating other guys, and the exhilaration of winning matches. It was fantastic.
And how much of this was driven by you, and how much was this being supported by your family?
It was just purely me. I mean, my mother. My father, unfortunately, my father died when I was only 13. So he never really got to see me play. He saw me play at home on the little table. And when I got to about 12, I got a 6x3 table that we used to put out in the garden or out in the garden shed. But he died when I was only 13. And my first competition was only a few months later in August. He died in June 1983. And quite suddenly, my first competition was a couple of months after that I actually won. So I was only 13. It was an under sort of 16 event, and so that was the unfortunate thing. My mother didn't want me to play snooker at all. As much as she bought a snooker table for me, she didn't want me to play at all because she used to chase me out of the snooker club around the corner from the house with the wooden spoon to get back and do my homework. Because as I said, I'd get off the bus in Renlea, straight into the snooker club, pass by the house, school bag under the table, and I'd stay there until around 6 o'clock in the evening until it was time for dinner. So my mother was always very insistent on education first. And that was something that I would tell my own child as well. And she was dead right. As long as I did my homework and got some good grades in school, I never missed from school. I never sort of played truant for fear of my mother and the wooden spoon for sure. And she always insisted, get a good education, do your homework, get your grades, and then you can play as much snooker as you like. Give it a go if you want. But yeah, she was quite sort of insistent on that, and it always sort of stood with me.
So that's interesting because that is identical to what happened to me growing up, where my mom actually put me into a school. It was a Christian Brothers school where we didn't even play football. And I was going over to Tottenham Hotspur at the time and I wasn't able to play football at school. So interesting, your mom is saying the same, how, education's the most important thing when actually snooker has given you a career and an incredible life that it did.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I think she was, I could understand what way she was thinking, because my own son who plays tennis now, but I always say to him, and he wants to like pursue it as much as he can. He's going actually to a tennis school now, but I always even say to him now, to say that, make sure your homework and your grades, you keep studying, you keep because. Your education as you go through life, and it doesn't matter what you achieve in sport or whatever, your education will always stand to you. And I think that was very, very important. And yes, you get a great education in life through sport as well, and you can learn different things as you go on. But I think to start you off, to get you in that right frame of mind, I think the education part is very, very important. And so I was always very conscious of that. She was quite a fair woman, but she was tough, when she had to be. But I think I appreciate that more as I get over, as I get older, and I've sort of became a parent myself.
Yeah, it sounds almost the exact same as my mum. I don't know whether we actually are brothers and we had the same mum or not, but that is the same story that we got growing up. But interestingly, Ken, and again, apologies, I didn't realize that about your father passing away whenever you were only 13. I wasn't aware of that until you've just shared that with me and everyone listening. But can I ask how much of that, really tragic event at a really, young age in life, how much do you think that either impacted or influenced your snooker?
I think it did a lot, subconsciously it did a lot. It sort of gave me a great drive. It sort of, I started, lots of those images of sitting with my dad watching the World Championship, watching Higgins win it in 82. And he was always a Ray Reardon fan. And I was always, of course, up for Alex Higgins. So we shared some great times in that respect, like watching the snooker matches, watching Pot Black. He was sort of introduced me to snooker first of all. So yeah, I mean, it's sort of a, it's a feeling that sort of I have a regret of, that you never actually got to see me play, even in any competition or win anything, of all those years. But certainly I always felt that he was always there on my shoulder, always in the back of my mind. I was always driving me forward, trying to be the best I could, trying to, just trying to always sort of dig in, never give up, always have that sort of, no matter how far you were behind, you'd always sort of keep trying, keep playing as well as you could, and never give in. And yeah, I always felt, even when I won the World Championship, I said to myself, and when I came off the table, I said, this was from my father, and of course, for all the rest of my family who were back in Dublin, but particularly he was in my mind, the forefront of my mind when I was lifting up the trophy.
So that's really, really powerful, and I think that is an amazing and hopefully inspirational story to the people listening of just what you can do when you have that kind of feeling of belief of wanting to do it, not just for yourself but for your family and everyone else. And interestingly, again, I just want to go back on something else you said there, Ken, because you talked about how you were a decent footballer, you enjoyed the football, captain in the team, and yet you left that team environment to go and be, an individual athlete, an individual player. Was that a difficult transition, or was it more naturally suited to you?
No, it was difficult enough because I was, as I said, I was captain of the team, and the football I absolutely love. I still love it today. I go back and play with my friends on a Wednesday now. We have like an 8-9-a-side on the Astro, and I absolutely love it. But no, it was a conscious decision because, like, on Saturday mornings we were playing matches, all over Dublin, whatever, in the leagues and stuff like that. But on Saturday morning in the local snooker club in Jason's where I played, we used to have a Saturday morning handicap tournament, snooker tournament. And more often than not, I used to win that tournament, whether I'd be given, 50 starts, 60 starts, 70 starts. It was only like £5 in, and the winner would get like maybe 30 or £40. But I wanted to be in there playing, snooker in that tournament every Saturday, as opposed to going out on a bus and go and play football with the lads. I always, even though I loved the team environment, I was more of an individual, and snooker sort of suited me more. I was getting more fun out of it. I was getting a greater rush out of it. And of course, the onus was all on me, as opposed to, worrying about your teammates trying to help out or pulling their weight or stuff like that. I knew that if I pulled my weight on the snooker table, more often than not, I was gonna win this competition every Saturday. And of course, I was getting a few bob as well. I was getting like 30, 40, £50, which at a 13 or 14, 15, no, sorry, 15 I was then, 14, 15. It was always nice going to school on the Monday morning, with a pocket full of change, and you'd be buying sweets and stuff like that. So, but also what it was doing, it was a great sort of grounding sort of for me. And learning experience about playing under pressure, giving starts, having to give 70 or 80 or sometimes even 100 starts to some of the other members, but trying to win under that pressure. So that was a great sort of breeding ground for me as I sort of progressed as an amateur and became, up through the ranks, even as an amateur in Ireland.
And that really is the complete opposite of, you know, jokingly about how we seem like to be identical growing up. But then that's the opposite of everything I've done in my life, because I've always been in a team environment. I love being around people. I get so much energy from others. And yet you're suddenly more drawn to that individual life, and it's almost solitary, because I'm guessing as you get later on and you start practicing by yourself all the time. What would you say was the kind of the pros and cons of suddenly going into that individual sport?
Yeah, I mean, the pros obviously is that, you know, the onus is on yourself to put in the work and try and develop your own skills and develop your sort of mental attitude and your sort of your will to win, your psychology of the game. The sort of cons against it are sort of, I mean, I love team sports. I love playing football. As I said, I still love playing now. And I love being around the mates and the banter and stuff like that. And I suppose going back to snooker, you're always on your own, you know, and that they're sort of the downsides, you know, that you travel on your own or you're being on your own most of the time. The guys that you would meet at snooker tournaments, they're all trying to buy up the same prize. So even though you get on well, you might have a little bit of banter, but at the end of the day, when you get on that snooker table, it's sort of... you know, every man for himself, basically, you know, and it doesn't matter who you are playing. I mean, if you're playing your brother, your sister, your mother on the snooker table, you still want to win. You know, you have to have that drive mentality to try and win and be the best you can. Whereas, like, in football, sometimes, you know, you'd be relying on other guys playing well with you. You know, no matter how much you tried hard, if the other guys weren't pulling their weight, you know, you could still get beat. And that was the very frustrating thing about playing football. But that was the great thing that I loved about playing snooker.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
I can, you're talking about, you know, this sort of fledgling love of snooker and starting to do well, starting to earn a couple of pounds, you know, at the weekends in the local club. When did things really become serious for you? Or maybe when did you make the decision that this could be a potential career for you?
When I finished school, I finished my Leaving Cert in 1987. And then I went back to repeat in 1988, a couple of subjects that I thought I could have done better in those years that you could actually amalgamate the two years of your best subjects. So I did that. I won the Irish Amateur Championship in 1987, and then so I was basically the top dog in Ireland as an amateur. Now, as the senior amateur, it's not as obviously as junior. I was about 17 at the time. I lost in the very first round of the amateur championships in 1988 when I was trying to defend the title. And I sort of, after that defeat, I thought, I can't stay in Ireland anymore. If I want to progress and try and be the best I can be, I can't stay in Ireland, because in Ireland, there were only so many good players. I knew that in England, there were so many more, and there was pro-ams, and I could sort of develop a lot better against better players. So I decided to make a conscious decision to just go to England and just try it out, you know. And I made that decision in 1988. I had £500 that I'd saved up. I went across to England with a fellow from Cork called Anthony O'Connor. We were staying in Diggs in Chiswick, in his mother's cousin's place. We got free snooker. Eugene Hughes, who was Irish professional in Ilford Snooker Centre, which was on the east side of London, got us some free snooker over there. So we'd have to travel from Chiswick all the way to Ilford, which was 36 stops on the district line. It took us an hour and a half. Then we had to get two buses. So we'd go 36 stops every day over there, get off, get two buses to Ilford, and then practice every day. And then get back on the two buses, get back on the district line, and another 36 stops all the way back to Chiswick. We did that for 2 weeks. And it was like a nightmare. It took us 2 hours to get there and 2 hours back. And then we had to play the snooker in between. And but luckily, Eugene Hughes said, why don't you try and get some digs over here? I'll put you up for a couple of weeks and try and get your own little place over here, a little apartment and stuff like that. So that's what we did. So we ended up staying with him for about 6 weeks until we got a little... we rented this little sort of B&B with an Irish couple. There was 50 quid a week, which you do your washing, you get bed and breakfast, and we were happy out. We were getting free snooker in Ilford Snooker Centre. And I remained there, right up until 1998. So after I won the World Championship in 97. But it was all down to Eugene Hughes getting us the table, getting us the free time, and sort of putting us up and helping us settle in. And there was another few snooker lads that had come over from Ireland. So there was a great sort of, there was a great little sort of Irish community in that part of Essex and Ilford. And we had the Shannon Centre beside us. We, you know, lots of Irish would congregate at weekends. So it was a nice community, and it was a great place to practice. And that was the first time I'd sort of met Ronnie O'Sullivan. He was only 12 years of age. And I used to practice with him even then, all those years back.
Well, listen, there's so many things. You've suddenly jumped from going over to London, and then you stayed there to 98, and you'd already become the world snooker champion by that stage, as well as meeting Ronnie. So many things I need to pick up on from those great stories. So what was the kind of turning point whenever you're practicing every day, you're just around the corner from where you need to go to the snooker hall? What was it that made you think, I either need to do more, or was there someone that was leading the way that you wanted to follow and copy?
Well, I mean, there was Eugene Hughes, who was the resident professional, as I said. I used to sort of practice with him. He was on the tour. He'd been on a successful sort of winning side with Alex Higgins and Dennis Taylor, winning the World Cup for Ireland. And he had great experience, he had great knowledge, and he passed that on. And even practicing with him, watching the way he sort of make breaks and stuff like that. And but when you went into that environment, it was completely different to the way I was back in Ranelagh and Jason's. Even though I'd sort of, you know, did 4 or 5 hours, but over there, you know, you had 5 or 6 different players, top quality players, top quality amateur players, as well as Eugene, the professional, that you could play off every single day, almost like sparring partners. So I'd go in, I'd do my like hours, maybe 2 hours solo practice, and then I'd take on these guys every day, you know, and play them all day long. Like, you know, we'd spend like 10 hours in the snooker club there. And it was just great. I was learning so much. I was getting so much sharper. I was building confidence, because when I'd come over from Ireland, I didn't know what to expect. You know, I knew I was half decent in Ireland, but against all these players in England, and also at weekends, we had sort of pro-ams around the country where I used to hitch lifts or jump on buses or get trains to. Playing in the competitions really sort of improved my game no end, like at least by 21 points. And I started to win them. I started to win some of them, and I started to build up a bit of confidence. And then it sort of just snowballed from there. I started to get a little bit of belief in myself, belief that I didn't have as much before, to realize that sort of these guys, as much as I sort of put them on a pedestal, you know, I started to beat some of them, and I started to get a bit of confidence. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, I think I can do this now. You know, I wasn't quite sure before, but I think I can do it. You know, I might be able to make some sort of a living out of this, and might be able to turn professional. I mean, I wasn't even a professional at this. I was still only an amateur.
And that's where I'm really fascinated, because I know that whenever I left Belfast at 16 to join Tottenham Hotspur, I definitely had an inferiority complex. You know, I was walking in with the likes of Jurgen Klinsmann and Teddy Sheringham and, you know, later David Ginola-Lesford. And I just thought, there's no way I could ever do that. And I'm wondering if you had my kind of mentality leaving Ireland and going across to England, or did you have a bit more self-belief and thinking, you know what, I know I am good. And then suddenly the tournament wins just cemented that belief you already had.
I was looking forward to the challenge. It wasn't that I had sort of a complete inferior complex. You know, I had sort of belief in myself, but maybe I put these other guys on too much of a pedestal. And it was only when I started to beat them that I sort of, my confidence grew and grew. But I always felt that, you know, if you work hard, you know, you put in the work, give yourself a chance, you know. There's always a great saying that when you're behind, you never give up, but when you're ahead, you never let up. I always felt that, you know, as long as I keep trying, I had a great sort of all-round game that sort of would stand to me. I could able to hold myself together under pressure. And even though I put these guys on pedestals, when I started to beat them, it sort of gave me that sort of belief, you know, that I could compete with some of the best amateurs in the world. I was winning sort of pro-ams against, like, you know, fields of 128 players on weekends. And very, very quickly, I became one of the best players in the whole of England, which was fantastic. And that gave me untold confidence. And so it was a slow burner. It took me like a couple of years, but I ended up turning professional then in 1990. I went to the World Amateur Championships in 1980. There's a couple of things that happened to me actually in 1988 and 1989. I tried to get onto the professional circuit, and I missed out just by one match, two matches actually. I got down to the top sort of 24 amateurs in the whole of the country. We had a series of like qualifying tournaments, but I just missed out. A guy called Dave Harrell beat me, so I had to start back right from the beginning again and then try and work myself back up. I came back to Ireland to play in the Irish Amateur Championship, which would give me a ticket to go to the World Amateur Championship, which was held in Singapore that year, and that was 1989. And as much as the devastating of actually not getting on the pro circuit that year, it actually helped me because I was absolutely devastated. I remember coming back to Ilford, I took the queue, I threw it under the bed. I didn't want to see the queue for a couple of weeks. I sort of made the decision then, okay, I have to go back to Ireland, I have to win the Irish Amateur Championship. That will give me a ticket to go to the World Amateur Championship. And if I win that, I'll get a ticket onto the professional circuit the following year, which would have been 1990. So that's what I did. I went back, I won the Irish Amateur Championship in the Royal Dublin Hotel in O'Connell Street. I beat Anthony O'Connor in the final. And then I went to the World Amateur Championship in Singapore in 1989. And I beat a guy called John Birch 11-2 in the final, who was also trying to turn professional that year. And once I won the World Amateur Championship, it was a huge tournament to win. And it gave me a ticket to turn professional the following year. But it actually, looking back, losing out in 1988 was actually a sort of a blessing in disguise.
And it's interesting how those down moments or learning moments, if you might want to call it that, how they can have such, you know, huge benefits for us, even though we might not realize it at the time. And also just wanted to pick up on whenever you talked about meeting a 12-year-old Ronnie O'Sullivan, could you see, even at that age, what potentially could go on to, or was he just another good young player who was, you know, a little bit precocious?
Oh, no, he was a precocious talent, cracking young player. He got a wonderful attitude. He used to actually come to some of the pro-ams and he'd sit in the front row and watch me play my matches. His father used to send a taxi for me to go around to his house. He had a table at the bottom of his garden in Ilford, and his father used to ring me up and say, look, can you come around and have a set with Ronnie? I said, yeah, of course. And we used to go around there and, you know, go down the bottom of the garden and play a couple of best of 19s, come in for a bit of lunch, then go back out for another best of 19. And I could tell even from then he had a wonderful talent. I was 18, he was only 12. But still, he was a great practice partner to play with. And as he sort of grew up, you know, he became better and better and just knew his sort of potential. He was making like century breaks at 12 years, at 10 years of age. You know, I didn't make my first century until I was about 13. But he was making them at 10. He was making 147s by the time he was 12. He was just an amazing, amazing talent. I always say, though, you know, when people ask me about who's the best player you've ever played, I said, well, probably Ronnie O'Sullivan, but I used to beat him 10-2, 10-3 every day. Now, he was only 12 at the time, but it still counts in my book.
Absolutely. You're taking that all day long.
The funny thing was, like, as we sort of grew up, he played in Ilford and we had table, like, next to each other. But for the World Championship in 1997, I'm just skipping forward a little bit, but the World Championship in 1997, we made a conscious decision to practice with each other every single day. And we sort of, before that, we were sort of playing intermittently, not playing each, even though we were playing in the same club, he'd play somebody, I'd play someone. And we sort of became a little bit rivals, you know, because we were playing each other in professional tournaments and sometimes I'd beat him or he'd beat me. So we sort of had our sort of relationship sort of, it wouldn't have been, it was more of a professional relationship rather than a sort of a friendly relationship, you know. But for that 2 weeks before that World Championship in 97, we made a conscious decision, okay, come on, let's just have a best of 19 every day. Just let's both of us try and get as sharp as we can and see what we can do in this World Championship. And it really sort of sharpened me up and sharpened him up as well. I mean, he made that 147 in 5 minutes and 20 seconds that year, which was a record that will never, ever be beaten. It was quite incredible. I mean, it used to take Peter Ebdon 5 minutes and 20 seconds just to break off, you know? So for him to make a 147 was quite incredible. Yeah, and of course, I went on to win the World Championship the same year when he made that magical 147. So that bit of practice together really sort of benefited both of us.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And Ken, I really have, I'd love to just talk for the entire 60 minutes about the final and winning it in 97 against Stephen Hendry. I know you've done so much of that before, but I suppose from my point of view, I'm just so fascinated by this world of mindset, mental performance and psychology and, you know, everything around it. So just as a kind of starting point, before you went into that match, into the final, you'd obviously done really well, performing really well to get to the final. What was your mindset or belief like before you'd even stepped into the arena?
I'll tell you, the start of that tournament, and this is the way things can really sort of change. The start of that tournament, I was sort of under a bit of pressure. I had a really sort of bad sort of couple of tournaments before the World Championship. I lost 6-0 to Davis in the Masters in Wembley. I lost 6-1 to him over here, Steve Davis, at the Irish Masters. And I was sort of struggling to stay in the top 16. I was an established top 16 player, but if I didn't win my first match at the World Championship, I could have been knocked out of the top 16, which was would have been a huge loss. And you know, financially, as well as, you know, having a top 16 season for the following year was a big thing. So I was only sort of really thinking about my first match, which was against a guy called Mark Davis in the very, very first round. And that was really all I was concentrating on going into that year. And as sharp as I was in practice in the build-up to playing with Ronnie O'Sullivan, also I was thinking, don't think too far ahead, just try and win this match. You win this match, you're guaranteed your top 16 place, and then you're into the tournaments, best of 25s, and then let's see how it goes from there. I had a really tough match with him. I eventually beat him 10-8 in the end, and it was very, very tough. But it was like almost like a huge release. I was guaranteed top 16. It was sort of the pressure just sort of was lifted off my shoulders. I was playing Steve Davis in the second round, who had absolutely trashed me, as I said, 6-0, 6-1. But I had a completely different mindset. I had sort of got my confidence back, had a bit more belief in myself, and I thought, okay, Davis, you beat me, you're one of the best players, but you're going to have to scrape me off this table to beat me this time because, you know, I'm gonna really sort of put as much effort as I can in. Not that I didn't before, but just going to try and try and try, and you're going to face a different Ken Doherty. I'm not going to let you sort of dominate the game and dictate the pace of the game. I'm just going to, you know, come out for and play with confidence, play quickly around the table, get you out of your comfort zone and then see what happens. And I got off to a wonderful start. I was 6-2 up after the first session. The first frame of the evening session, Davis came out, we won the first frame and he gave it the fist. And I'd never seen Davis give it the fist before so early in a match, just because he won that frame. And he was still 6-3 behind. And I thought, well, if he's going to do that just to win one frame, he must be seriously under pressure, you know? And in a way, that sort of gave me that bit, a little bit of confidence. And it sort of made me even more determined. And I said, okay. I said to myself, all right, up yours, Davis. I said, you're going to get it from me now. And I eventually beat Davis 13-3. I beat him with a session to spare. It's never happened to Steve Davis at the World Championship in the Crucible in his whole career. So to beat him with a session to spare, was a huge confidence booster, a huge feather in my cap. And then I went on, I just felt like so tall, like going into that arena. I felt like, you know, I was really sort of so comfortable. I played John Higgins in the next round. I beat him 13-9. And then before I got to the final, I played Elaine Robidoux in the semi-final from Canada, another top 16 player. I beat him with a session to spare, 17-7. So going in, I'm playing Stephen Hendry in the final now. And Stephen Hendry hasn't lost a match at the Crucible for the previous 5 years. He's gone for six in a row. But the one thing that I had in my own mindset was that I could see myself lifting the cup. You know, they talk about visualization. I dreamt about lifting that cup from when I got that first snooker table when I was eight. And when I was in the final for that couple of weeks, I saw myself lifting the cup and giving it a big kiss, just like Higgins did in 82 when he was crying with the baby, just like Dennis Taylor did in 85. I could actually see myself lift the cup and lift it up to the ceiling lights and give it a big kiss. And whether it was a dream or visualization, whatever it would have been, those images sort of kept me really calm. And even though I was playing the greatest player that's ever played the game, that's ever been at the Crucible, Stephen Hendry, as I said, he was going for six tournaments in a row. I had that belief, that sort of a calmness about it. I went out there, played with a smile on my face, even though I was a little bit nervous, of course I was, but I was loving every single minute of it. And I think the fact that the calmness, the sort of visualization, the belief, the dream, everything sort of gave me that sort of extra sort of calmness to go and play my game, not worry about who I was playing, not worry about Stephen Hendry, keep him in the seat as long as possible. And that, without a shadow of a doubt, helped me win that world championship, because otherwise I would have been as nervous as a kitten, and he probably would have, like, you know, stamped all over me and shown a sort of, you know, a sort of authoritative class, you know, that he had. But I didn't let him do that. I didn't let him bully me. In fact, I was bullying him with the way I was playing. And that's how I won the world championship in 97.
Yeah, amazing. Just absolutely amazing to hear that and win it by 18-12. Such a great margin of victory as well. So I've got a little bit of a kind of a question exercise. I'm not sure how to pose this, but essentially, because you won, because you're now, you know, world snooker champion, whenever I think about the performance of football and me trying to improve and how I sort of put it down to, you know, I would say you could probably divide performance into the technical aspect of what you do, the physical aspect, the psychological aspect, and then also the social. So with those four kind of areas of performance in mind, just thinking about you in the final, what percentage of all those four areas, Ken, do you think was most important for you winning the World Snooker Championship in 1997?
I think definitely the psychology. Without a shadow.
Even in terms of a number, even in terms of numbers, what kind of numbers would you say, you know, 25, 25, 25, or what?
Your technique has to be pretty sound. You know, of course, you have to have a really good technique, particularly in snooker, you know, because of the stillness on the shot and keeping the cue straight and not moving, you know, technically, you know, with your grip and your bridge, everything has to be pretty sound. So technically, you know, say, I don't know, maybe 20%. I'd say 20% to the other parts of the game, but certainly maybe 60% to the psychology, because it's amazing. You talked at the top of the interview about the little sort of the 6 inches between the ears, you know, in sport and in life generally. But I think particularly in sport, about your mindset, about your sort of psychology, about your confidence, about the sort of not worrying about whether you miss this shot, is he going to, you know, win the frame from? So all that sort of comes into question. And sometimes you'd be sitting in your chair and you'd be questioning yourself. And that's the sort of, they're the worst times when you're sat down, because your mind is sort of, you sort of think a lot more and you start to worry, you know, what's going to happen here? What's going to do this? And particularly against Stephen Hendry in that final, you know, I went 15-7 up. And the first to 18, he came back to 15-12. He won five frames in a row. And that was when I was at my most nervous. That was when I doubted myself, because I'd seen Stephen Hendry come back against different players throughout his career. And I was sitting in my chair and I'm thinking, please don't do this comeback. Not to me. Not now. Not in this position that I'm in. I will never get over this. You know, so I was dealing with that in my mind. And I'm trying to, you're trying to put positive thoughts in your mind. You just say, no, just play your game. You get one chance, you're going to win the frame. And you're questioning yourself, you're talking to yourself. But if you keep yourself in a positive mind about how you're playing and how you got here and the matches that you won and how well you played, even in this final alone, that's so, so important in sport. And particularly in individual sports and snooker, it comes into effect more often than not. And I think, yeah, my psychology, my mindset, my confidence was pretty good. And of course, as I said, the belief and the visualization really, really helped, you know.
And that's where, you know, this is why I love this subject, Ken, because when you're talking about, you're sitting there with just one frame to go to lifting the World Snooker Championship, and you're still thinking that, you know, is it the little voice in your head that's kind of going to be the difference? Is it you almost trying to bring yourself back to a way of thinking, oh, I need to think a bit more, you know, constructively or a little bit more helpfully? And yet probably snooker is one of those sports that whenever you're playing it, it's probably quite unique that if someone else is on the table, you physically can't do anything and there's nothing you can do to stop. Whereas if I'm playing football, you know, I can stop them. I can stop them from tackling, you know, pretty much snooker is the only one where you have to kind of sit there and you have no way of doing anything until you're back at the table. That must be really difficult to deal with.
I think that's the hardest part about the game, is that you can do absolutely nothing. As you said, in football or, you know, team sports, you can tackle or, you know, take the ball from the other opponents. In snooker, you just have to sit there and wait. You know, in golf, you have your own ball. You just worry about your own shot, your own technique, you know, and whatever hole you might be playing. But in golf or in snooker, yeah, you've just got to sit and wait. And sometimes, you know, you might not make a mistake. You might, like, just play a break off. He puts a long ball and he goes on to make a century and you're sitting there for the whole frame. He might get a fluke, you know, he might play a safety shot, might go wrong, he flukes a red and he's banging amongst the balls and he goes on to make another century, you know. So sometimes you can't do anything. That's the hardest part, I think, about snooker. One of the toughest part, if not the hardest part about the game. And that's where your mindset and your psychology has to be right, to keep yourself sort of on the edge, that knowing that when you do get your chance, you have to be ready. So you have to keep sort of saying to yourself, keep giving yourself sort of positive thoughts all the time, to make sure that when your concentration, when you're at the table, that your concentration is full on, that you haven't sort of wavered, that you haven't let your mind go, and that you're still in a really good place to sort of finish a frame that if you do get the chance. So yeah, it is quite difficult. And for those frames when Stephen Hendry was coming back, you know, you're praying that he gets a kick or he miscues or, you know, anything just to get you back at the table. And he missed one red where he should have gone, he should have actually gone 15, 30. We would have had a break, gone to the dressing room, had a little interval. And I made a 60 break and I played a stupid shot and he got back in and he was going to make a 60-odd break and win the frame. And he missed one red down behind the black, down along the cushion, and it stayed in the jaws of the pocket. Two reds left on 30-something in front. I only need a red and a colour. Well, I leapt out of the chair like a greyhound. I couldn't believe this. I ran. I couldn't get to the table. To pot the red, pot the black, pot the other red, and I'm 16-12. I sort of broke the momentum of Stephen Hendry. We go into the dressing room, and I'm 16-12. Now I'm two from the front instead of being two ahead. You know, 15-30. It was a huge frame. And that was his chance gone. And then sort of relaxed me again. I came out and I won the last two frames. But yeah, once I got that frame, it was a big relief. And then I sort of got my confidence, got my momentum again. And that's what happens in snooker. You know, one missed shot can change the whole perspective on a match. And that's exactly what happened. And that helped me win the World Championship.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Again, interest mode, we just talked about how snooker, when you're not at the table, it's almost you can't do anything to control the situation. And I don't know why I just thought of this analogy or almost how this can apply to life, because how does that ability to deal with that in snooker help you? Because I'm guessing in life the same things happen, that you could be going about your business and suddenly something completely out of your control come and, you know, takes you out from the side. And that must be really difficult to deal with. But hopefully the skills you've built up in snooker could potentially help you with that. Would that be right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like in sports, you sort of get knocks all the time, you know. And like, you know, I always say, Jenny, I wish I could have, you know, like at 97 when I was in that final, or just for those couple of weeks, that I wish I could have bottled it, you know, and like just drank it for every like sort of world championship thereafter. But it doesn't work out like that, you know. Sometimes, yeah, like things can happen and you get a lot of knocks in the game. You know, listen, you know, maybe, you know, as you said, like you spent a whole career trying to be world champion, you know, and you remember just for that world championship. But it was, you know, there's been a lot of knocks on the way. There's been a lot of knocks afterwards, you know, but that's the journey of being a sports person. That's the journey of life, really. You know, you take your knocks in life. But you sort of you pick yourself up, you dust yourself down, you put it down to experience, and then you try and, you know, make it better next time, or you try and learn from it and try and keep going. You know, I think that's the important thing, is that you keep going. Whatever knocks, whatever life does throw at you, that, you know, you just got to dust yourself down and just try and keep going as best you can. And if you're involved in a sport, you just got to keep trying. And, you know, the knocks will come all the time, but you put them down to experience. And that's the part of the journey, you know. And they always say, like, the journey is better than the end, you know. And sometimes it is, you know, because, you know, I've had a wonderful life, a career, meeting so many people, you know, through the different stages of my professional career. And now I'm in the twilight sort of time of my career, but I'm still enjoying it. I look back with a lot of fondness of the bad times, of even when I was renting the bed and breakfast, of even when I was getting on that, you know, that tube, 36 stops. You know, I look back on that and sort of smile to myself, and I look back on it with fondness, as difficult as it was. You know, I had £500 in my pocket. I was moving to London. That's all I had in the world, you know. But I look back on a lot of the stuff with fondness, you know, because they not only build you up in my sport as a snooker player, but also in life as well, you know, to sort of, it gets you ready for what's ahead of you in life, you know. And I try and pass those things on a little bit by little, even though my son doesn't listen to me too much. But I try and pass those little things on. But it's always, it's the knocks that you have to get on with, and you just have to accept them sometimes. But you have to learn from them. I think that's the most important thing.
And I think that that's such a great message to share from someone who's, you know, pretty much been at the summit. You know, you've been at the top of the mountain, you've been the best in the world. That's probably quite difficult for someone who's hasn't been at the summit, is still at the bottom, but is looking up there thinking, I'd really love to get there, but I keep getting these disappointments. And I'm just wondering how you might share anything, Ken, that might be able to help someone who, whether they're an aspiring snooker player, sportsman, or anyone just have with any aspirations in life.
I've been to the top of the mountain, but I've certainly been to the bottom of the mountain a lot of times as well. also I would say is, look, you have to enjoy what you do. You know, you have to, as I said, you're going to get knocks. It's going to be very, very difficult. But you have to keep believing in yourself and keep doing your best, you know, and try and you tick all the boxes, you know, you cover every angle that you can and try and give it 100%, you know. And that's all you can do in life. You try and give everything 100%. If you're going to do something, give it 100%. And even if it doesn't work out, well, at least you've said to yourself, your conscience is clear. I've done my best. I've tried to cover every angle. I've tried to improve myself as best as I can. And if it's not to be, it's not to be. But at least you can go on in life and say, I did my best at that, as to try to be a professional sportsman or whatever I tried to do. But if I didn't get to the top, I didn't become, not everybody can become world champion, you know, and I feel very blessed that I am. Not everybody can get to the top, but what you can do, you can have a great journey just trying to get to the top. You know, you can have great experiences, you'll have great life experiences, and they will sort of, they will stand to you in different parts of life that you will take as you go along, you know, when you take up something else and your sport doesn't work out for you. But, you know, I think that's the key thing, is that to enjoy the bad times as well as the good times, you know, and there will be bad times along the way, but you have to just give it your best. And if it doesn't work out, you can sleep at night and your conscience is clear, but enjoy the journey at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's really is the skill and the difficulty that, you know, must be harder to enjoy the tough times, the bad times. And you mentioned there, Ken, about how you're now, you called it in the twilight of your career. How have you dealt with that almost transition from, yeah, you know, playing, winning titles, all the rest of it, to suddenly not performing at the same level, not having the same, yeah, expectations, and almost just not being able to do what you could do, knowing that you're, yeah, now doing something else with your life?
It is. It is very frustrating now as you get a bit older, because you think, you know, your mind is still as active as enthusiastic as it ever was, you know? And I still love the game. And I know I can't perform like I did like when I was 27, you know? So it's a hard one to get your head around it, to sort of, accept that. But you just have to, you know, I've come to the realization, look, I'm not the player I was like 20 years ago. So in the few years that I have left playing, just enjoy it. Try and do the best you can. I watched Phil Mickelson last night, 51, winning the PGA Championship, which was fantastic. I mean, that was, you know, very inspirational what he has done. And, you know, I try and still give it 100%, try and still do as best as I can. But now the knocks are, even though they're knocks, I don't take them so hard on myself. Before, like when I'd lose and go into the apartment, like the queue would go under the bed, you know, and I'd sit in and I'd hope and watch TV for a couple of days until I got the courage to come back out and go back up to the snooker club and expect all the stick I was going to get from all the boys up there. But now I just, you know, I forget about it. I sort of, you know, if I lose, I lose. I don't take it to heart as much. I just get on with it and look forward to the next one. You know, as I said, I've had a wonderful career. I still love playing, and I still love being around the snooker circuit. I'm still involved with the World Snooker Association, and of course I do the TV work, which I really enjoy. And that sort of, you know, that sort of, that's part of my life now, you know, and playing is not as a priority as it once was. So playing now is just sort of, I'm just playing for more of enjoyment and, you know, trying to win a match here or there and trying to do as best I can, but it's not sort of the be and end all as it once was.
And is there an element of legacy to do with being involved with the World Snooker Association? Because I believe you're chair, is that right, from what I read?
I'm chairman of the players' board. Yeah, no, I just, I love the game. You know, I want to see it progress. I want to see it, you know, improve it in lots of different aspects and fulfill its sort of potential. And I want the best for the players as well. You know, I want, you know, the best conditions, the best tournaments and the best, you know, the best for the players and the players' rights. And I think that's very, very important, that we need a body to stand up for the players. I think that's very, very important for, you know, to be able to work with World Snooker Limited and create a really as best model as we can, you know, going forward. So, yeah, that's part and parcel of it. But the other work as well, you know, the BBC work I love doing. I love being around the likes of Virgo and Taylor and Davis and Hendry and Barrett. We have such good laugh, you know, we have such good fun. Alan McManus as well. You know, it's more like they're my snooker family, I call them, you know. So we get on great, we have nice meals, we have great banter, and we go out and play a little bit of golf together, and just really good sort of social times. And I think, they're my snooker family.
Yeah, and again, seeing you on the TV doing it, you look like you're having a blast with all the guys all the time. And I suppose I've got a couple of questions for you, Ken, now. I can't believe this 60 minutes has flown by. So the two questions that I kind of generally want to end on, because, it you know, you talked about absolutely the best times in your career, some tough times along the way. Has there been a price to having the success that you've had in your career?
has there been a price? I suppose, I think, you know, the price would have been away from your family quite a bit, being on the road quite a bit. You know, we have a young son now, he's 13. So, you know, being away from him a little bit as he was sort of growing up. And also my other, you know, my siblings, my two brothers, my sister, my mom passed away in 2017. But, you know, those would have been the times, you know, not spending as much time with them over the years and not seeing them as much as I would have liked. They would have been sort of the tough times, you know. But I suppose the good times outweighed them. You know, when I came back, I got off the plane into Dublin with the World Championship trophy, and my mother was waiting at the bottom of the steps of the plane, and I handed it to her, you know, and I said, "This is for you, ma'am," you know. And she took it back to Ranelagh, back to our house in Ranelagh, and she stuck it on top of the TV, and she used to clean it every day. And to see her face after all the, you know, the years of traveling here and there with your queue, or going into Jason's and Renlet, or going into town with the queue on the bus, or all those times being away, and she'd be worrying about me, you know, that it was sort of, it would have been worth it in the end, you know. And I'm sure my father was looking down on me as well with a little sort of smile on his face too. So those times sort of make up for all this sort of the times that, you know, the down times basically, you know.
Yeah, and I actually just got goosebumps just as you're sharing that story with passing the World Snooker Championship trophy to your mum and her taking that back to the house. She must have been so proud.
That she had the door open of the house, you know, Paul, and she'd say, and people would be coming and be knocking the door, can we have a look at the cup, you know? And she'd say, yeah, come on in, there it is, it's on top of the TV, you know. So even all the sort of strangers would come in just to get a glimpse of the cup, and you could see it from the avenue, you know, on top of the TV as you pass by the window. Yeah, but she was so proud. She'd clean it every day. And she used to always tell me to give up snooker, you know, to sort of get a real job, you know, because it was so, she'd sort of be up and down with her emotion, her own emotions, you know, when I'd be playing. And she had to go through an awful lot as a mother. But it was worth it, you know, in the end. You know, she once, I'll tell you a funny story. She used to make cakes. She was a great baker, you know, and she used to make apple tarts for the local spar shop, you know, in Renlet. Yeah. And she'd do it every weekend. And in 1997, I was up in bed, you know, it was early morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know. I'd come in from a night out, I'd been home for a weekend, so I'd come in from a night out. I was up in bed, and she was baking the apple tarts, and she rang the shop for the manager to come up and collect the apple tarts, you know. So the manager says, "Oh, we're too busy, Miss Doherty. I can't come up. You'll have to wait maybe an hour or so." So, you know, so he said, "Don't worry." He said, "I'll send my son down," you know. So she's shouting up to me, get up out of that bed. So she gets me to bring down a breadboard full of apple tarts in the middle of Renlet. I'm 1997 world champion. And here I'm. I'm not the world champion in her eyes. I'm only still her son, Kenneth, that she used to call me, you know. "Get up out of that bed, Kenneth." And I'm walking down the middle of Renlet with a breadboard full of apple tarts that you sell it for £2 a go into the local spar shop. So I was brought firmly back down to earth. If ever I was going to get a big head, you couldn't get a big head in our house, that's for sure, you know.
yeah, I know that. I know that feeling very much. Keep your feet on the ground. Absolutely no possibility of doing that whenever you're from this part of the world. So last question for you then, Ken. As you said, you're in twilight of your playing career, but you've, you know, had a very successful career as a pundit and commentator on the snooker on TV now. But, you know, he's talking about your son, all the other things you've got going on, chair of the World Snooker Association. What would you say is the definition for you at this point in your life going forward?
I don't know. I think my success, you know, it's not the world championship, you know. I think it's just, look, I've had a great life, you know. I've had a wonderful life. I think that is success in itself. I've enjoyed, you know, so many different parts of the game, of the competition, you know, the adrenaline, like the highs and lows of playing a sport, the places that I've visited, the people that I've met, the, you know, the friendships that I've I've made, you know, and I still have like friends from when I started out as, you know, as a, you know, 10-year-old going into Jason's. I still have friends from those days, and they're still some of my best friends now. And I think that for me is, you know, is success. You know, whatever you know, the accolades that you collect along the way, they're not as meaningful, I think, as, you know, the journey of life and the friends that you meet along the way and the friendships and the bonds that you've made. And for me, I think that's more of a success than anything else. Like, you know, and the rest is just, it's just sort of, you know, they're just things, you know, they're just like cups or whatever. But I think, you know, the journey of life and the success of friendships and as you go through life, I think that's, for me, much more important.
Ken Doherty, thanks very much for joining us. I really, really enjoyed that.
My pleasure, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was just so interesting, speaking to another Irish guy, someone who's been a world snooker champion, being the best in the world at anything, and picking his brains and really trying to understand why he did what he did. And it was fascinating when he thinks that the reason why he beat Stephen Hendry in a world snooker final was about 60% down to his psychology. So hopefully that resonates with you. It certainly did with me. Hope you really enjoyed listening to Ken, and you'll join us again for another episode of The Psychology of Success. And a final thank you for everyone involved in making today's show. From producing, we've got Moment Digital with Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Hayley Brasnett is the editor. Dave Webster has been our researcher. And Emily Drake helps get us out all of our social media posts on the psychology of success.